In the Senate Interim Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development for today, the 8th of December. We have a group of informal meetings, and then at the end we're going to take action on some committee bills. So we need to be there to introduce those committee bills. That's probably the other part. And we have a couple members who, one that cannot be here and another who is late, and she'll be here shortly. So with that, we rearranged the order a bit because we had some conflicting people who had to get to a different place real quickly. So we're going to start with the Governor's Task Force on Genetically Engineered Agriculture. So Dan, if you want to come forward, and whoever all's coming, come on.
Gabriella too.
Oh, Gabriella's coming too. I'm doing a C-Grant fellow to sit up there too. You know, no.
You have great affection.
I do.
Good morning, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gabriella Goldfarb, Natural Resources Policy Advisor to Governor Kitzhaber. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today to provide an overview of the Governor's Task Force on Genetically Engineered, or GE, Agriculture. As many of you are aware, the governor formed the task force last spring, and the members represent very diverse perspectives around GE-related topics. The governor asked Oregon Consensus, the state's program for mediating policy agreement, to serve as a neutral forum for the task force conversations and to provide facilitation and process support. He appointed as co-conveners the fine people sitting next to me, Dan Arp, Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University, and Jennifer Allen, who is the director of the Institute for Sustainable Solutions at Portland State University. I'm going to leave most of the talking to them this morning after I provide a little bit of context. The governor did not ask the task force to come to consensus or to make recommendations around this issue. Rather, he charged the group with three primary objectives. The first was to identify and to frame the main challenges between growers of GE crops and other agricultural producers in Oregon. The second was to identify and describe areas of agreement and disagreement related to GE and non-GE food products, including and especially related to information for consumers. And third, to identify and describe what other jurisdictions have done or have proposed doing to address these issues. So the task force report, which is currently being finalized and which I believe you have a copy of or have access to a copy of, it's in public comment draft form. It addresses each of these objectives and we believe provides an important foundation for the governor, for members of this committee, and for others to inform the GE conversations that we anticipate will be taking place during the legislative session. The governor's office does have a legislative concept we will be introducing that was, of course, drafted well in advance of the task force's deliberations and their reports. So we are quickly going to be introducing an amendment to have that concept be informed by the task force report and findings. And that those revisions will be to look at concepts that support coexistence strategies, perhaps along the lines of market production districts, best practices, that type of thing. But for today, I want to turn things over to Jennifer and Dan. I want to take the opportunity to thank them and all the task force members who brought very firm convictions and a commitment to engage very productively and very civilly to the deliberations through often pretty challenging conversations. And thanks also go to Peter Harkema, who back there, and the team at Oregon Consensus, who did an excellent work in shepherding the conversation. So we'll turn it over to them.
I'll ask one question. Before we get away, I don't know that I've seen the draft, and so does anybody else know if they've
seen it? I've not seen it.
And so if you could make sure that Beth gets one so that she can get it to her, whatever.
It's online. I've got the link.
Oh, you do have the link. Yeah. She'll link it to us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that we ended up getting it because I saw the same.
Yes. You'd like to see the draft. And the final should be out within a couple weeks. Yeah. And we'll be sure to get that to the committee as soon as it's ready.
Thank you very
much. Thank you. So I'm not sure who's...
So for the record, my name is Dan Arp, and I'm Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University.
Thank you, Chairman Roebland, and members of the committee for giving us this opportunity to provide you an overview of the governor's task force on genetic engineering. As you are aware, dialogue related to GE issues has often been polarizing due to the passion that different stakeholders bring to this topic and the broad range of often conflicting perspectives. We believe that the work of this task force has accomplished much in shifting this dynamic among the task force members and helping to frame the issues so that the governor and legislature will have an opportunity to consider the issues in a way that reflects the full range of those often conflicting perspectives. Task force members had considerable expertise on GE topics, but this was not a panel made up only of scientists and was not charged with describing the state of science or scientific consensus. Rather, this report explains the task force members' perspectives on key GE-related topics. Task force met 11 times between April 2014 and October 2014. All meetings were open to the public. Public comments were accepted throughout the process, and a public meeting was held in early November. All public input can be found in the report appendix. Today, we would like to orient you to the structure and content of the task force report. We believe that the report will serve as a valuable resource to you as you consider these important topics facing our state. I should note that the report is still draft, as we are working with the task force members to address public comments received over the past couple of weeks. We do not expect the report to change significantly between the draft and the final version. The draft report is, as was just mentioned, available for download on the Governor's Natural Resources Office webpage. The final will be posted within the next couple of weeks. The report begins with a brief introduction, orientation to the task force purpose and goals, a list of topics discussed, and a list of the task force appointees. Jennifer Allen, my co-convener, will now walk you through the report.
Chairman Roebland, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jennifer Allen, director of Portland State University's Institute for Sustainable Solutions. So in the report, following the introduction, which Dan just mentioned, on pages 4 through 8 are a series of summary descriptions of the topics that arose during the course of the task force discussions. These sections include key policy considerations. This is a section that includes very brief overview of the topics that the task force members agreed would benefit from further policy consideration. We next move to a description of overarching themes, a number of overarching themes that emerged throughout the course of the task force discussion address various substantive topic areas. The themes will give you a sense of some of the topics that members discussed during the multiple subject matter conversations we had. An example of a theme would be that many of the issues that are encountered when you're managing GE crops are not exclusive to GE crops, but in fact apply more broadly to other crop types. Another example of a theme is the topic of risk and the need to allocate and balance risk with benefits and how one might approach that. The report then addresses areas of alignment and areas of disagreement. So these two sections describe areas where task force members found alignment and those topics where perspectives were most divergent. Examples of areas of alignment include the need for improved communication at all levels of GE discussions among farms, breeding experts, policy experts, and from growers and processors to consumers and vice versa. Many task force members noted that debates over GE issues have focused on fringe claims from both sides rather than really focusing on the key issues and providing an opportunity for more shared understanding of this issue. An area of disagreement was the topic of governance. The task force work was focused on GE issues in the state of Oregon, as it is situated in a broader regulatory market and agricultural context. As such, ODA's authority and the topic was of considerable conversation among the task force members. There were varied and divergent perspectives among members on whether ODA should or could take a larger role given its present authorities or if its authorities were changed. There is disagreement about the spectrum of voluntary and mandatory measures that might be imposed at the state level. Following these synthesis sections we just described are brief descriptions and examples of GE-related policies and efforts undertaken in other jurisdictions. This section is organized around, first, coexistence efforts in other states or counties, or countries, rather, that explore how all agricultural production and processing sectors, be it GE, conventional, and organic, can exist together. Second, it looks at labeling efforts in the U.S., and third, it looks at bans and restrictions in other jurisdictions. The report provides links to additional information on each of the efforts in the policy areas described above. The final section of the report provides task force member perspectives on the various topic areas discussed by the task force. So examples would be coexistence, food safety, ethics and values, and biodiversity. The report also includes a number of appendices that you may find useful, including background and the status of GE crops in Oregon, a brief description of the roles of the various state and federal agencies within the current regulatory landscape, a link to all of the resources shared by task force members as they conducted their work. At this link, you'll find a wealth of outside information on any of the topics included in the report, the governor's letter establishing the task force, and finally, a link to public comments. So we thank you again for the opportunity to join you today, and we welcome any questions you may have. Thank you.
So questions from any of our members? I guess my hope is, and I'm appreciative of the ground rules that were set, because I think that what we really need to have is a discussion, and the only way to have a real conversation is to have information. And I look forward to looking at the report to understand how those different things work. And I think that comment section may be the most important to me, because it gets at the root of where we have areas that we really need to figure out how we can make it work. And I was telling the people earlier, I just got back from a river cruise on the Rhine, and I don't think we want to do exactly like the German. The one grape region we're in, they have 7 grapes. That's it. The whole region, they get to grow 7 grapes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that our grape would like that very well if other people, the government, told you that's the only ones, and mm-hmm. our late, whatever, and as times change, if they could actually deal with that, because the weather might affect that. So it is interesting to see the different deals. And you've made reference in here to looking at other policies around the country and the world with regard to it. I think that's going to be important. And I think the fact that we had this, I don't know if we've even settled it, whether the GE bill that was it was so close. I mean, the issue is something that's important to a lot of Oregonians on either side. So I think it's timely and right, and I look forward to whatever bill the governor's going to introduce and the amendments that will strengthen what we're going to be doing with that. And I really commend all of you and the other committee members for being a part of this opening process. And again, when we were going through all the stuff, it was a promise made by the governor that we would have this conversation, and I am happy that it took place, and I look forward to using that information to hopefully be better informed. Yes, Senator Pazansky.
So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate everything that's being done, but I guess I'm wondering about what's the next step? Because the reality is you're going to bring us through all this work that you've done, and we're still going to be, I think, starting off at ground zero for our side of where do we start with the discussions. And to me, I hope that there's some means that we're going to actually have the ability to bring these active players to the table to give us recommendations, because we haven't done all the work that you've done over that 6-month period, 11 different meetings. I mean, there's a lot of time and management that's gone there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And be very frank, I mean, it's true. I mean, I think a lot of people wrote off 92 as being going down in flames when we found out it didn't. And so there is, as the chair said, a lot of concern here. And come 2016, if we don't deal with it in 2015, it will pass, whatever they put on the ballot, because just the sheer numbers. And so I'm hoping that we have a little bit more constructiveness so we can maybe take care of it through a legislative means instead of relying on another initiative.
I agree.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll stamp the informational meeting on the Governor's Task Force on GE Agriculture, and we'll open an informational meeting on forest health and biomass. So, Forrester Decker, come on
morning.
Up. And whoever else you want.
Okay. We have a cast of characters we're asking to join us this morning.
All right. And I I want to thank you again for being gracious about, we ran out of time last meeting. This was planned at that time, and that you graciously said we'll come back, and I thank you very much for that.
So. Very good. Thank you. Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Bertschiger, members of the committee, Beth. For the record, I'm Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester, Director of the Department of Forestry. And to your point, we're going to pick up with where we left off in September. You may recall that in September, we brought a package in to talk to you about forest health and the role of biomass as it relates to forest health. We really zeroed in on forest health, particularly on federal forests, and we didn't have time to finish the biomass piece. So today we're going to do that. I think we've got a number of folks here who are going to be kind of part of the biomass team who are going to be walking you through the opportunities and the challenges that we face related to increased utilization of forest biomass. I'm joined today by Marcus Kaufman, who is ODF's biomass specialist. And here at the table now is Levi Strayer with Bear Mountain Forest Products. In a moment in our lineup, Palmer Mason from DEQ will be here. He's behind us. He'll join us here at the table. And we're really going to kind of focus on the nexus that exists between forest biomass and forest health and fire risk and markets, rural economic development, and air quality. And really, biomass kind of exists at that intersection. We'd originally focused the presentation in September. It kind of tied it in with federal forests because of the significant amount of biomass opportunity that exists, particularly on the east side, where major efforts to increase the pace and scale of management and forest health on federal lands is underway. There's a lot of work to be done there, and it's producing significant amounts of smaller dimension material, and that's what woody biomass is. We have some pictures here we'll show you in a moment. In October, Brett Brownscombe and Chad Davis and I, Senator Bertschiger, participated. We led a tour to the Ben Sisters area to look at federal forest restoration work, and it's very helpful, and it's driven by collaboration, and it's producing some really positive results. But one of the takeaway messages from our visit there in October was I think we all left with an understanding of the need for further market development related to biomass. We went out and visited one of the sales there west of Bend, a project that was particularly productive of biomass, and the material was being hauled all the way to Boardman because there just was not yet a mature local market. And so there are some localized success stories, and you're going to hear about them here this morning. But there's more that we can do to create markets that can align with the growing abundance of material. And when you think about that intersection, the local market benefit ties directly to fire risk reduction by removing flammable material, by creating a more resilient forest landscape. And in that way, better utilizing forest biomass can really begin to transform local economies, giving landowners a bottom line to be able to continue to manage their lands, can help us manage fire risk, and can actually reduce catastrophic air quality impacts from wildfire as well. Woody biomass exists at that intersection, and we want to tell you more about it. And so we'll ask Marcus to kick us off.
Thank you, Doug. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marcus Kaufman. I'm the Biomass Resource Specialist for the Oregon Department of Forestry. Thank you for the opportunity to share some information with you all this morning. I have a very short PowerPoint. It just has four informational slides. And I'm basically going to talk about some of the benefits of utilizing forest biomass. I'll talk about where the market is, you know, the challenges with the market, and some considerations to think about as we really put this idea on the table of market development, and I'll close with some thoughts of what that market development might want to include. So, like Doug mentioned, we're talking about forest biomass, which could be slash, tops and limbs, defect, material left over from fire, insects, and disease. And it can be in the slash form, or it can be in roundwood. And if we're to kind of consider the broad picture of biomass, we also have mill residuals, which are considered woody biomass, and that would be shaving, sawdust, hog fuel from lumber mills. But for the most part, we're focused on forest biomass. So as Doug noted, there's a number of benefits from using forest biomass. And rather than kind of walk through each of these, this list here, I'll give you a couple examples, both from public land and from private land. So the Deschutes National Forest over in Central Oregon has been using stewardship contracts for about a dozen years to remove fuels and restore old-growth forests around Sisters and Camp Sherman. And they've become very adept with the use of that tool. And they have noted that when they have markets for biomass, for the small diameter material, the slash and the tops and limbs, the cost for their treatments can be reduced up to 50% because they have a market for that material. They've also noted that when they can put the utilization of biomass into a stewardship contract, that it speeds up the time in which they can complete their implementation. So the business as usual approach for the completing the work that they're doing is 2 to 3 years because they have to fall the whips, create hand piles, wait for that material to cure, and then come back and burn it the following season. When they have a market for that material and they can utilize it, it increases their implementation. They can sometimes get all that work completed in one season. So they shared some numbers with me, $175 an acre with utilization, and when there's no utilization, no market for biomass, the cost goes up to $380 an acre. So for them, when there is a market, it's a cost containment strategy. Their scarce federal resources can go farther and they can treat more acres. Turn into a private land example, the MC Ranch, which is a 30,000 acre ranch 12 miles southwest of La Grande, they do about 1 million board feet of timber sales a year, and their program is really focused on thinning of small diameter material, small size class, 3 inches to 12 inches. And if they don't have a market for that small material, they essentially pile it up and burn it. And that's a challenge for them because they're very close to the La Grande airshed, so they have a very small window. So having to pile and burn adds both time, cost, and risk to their operations. But when they have a market for that biomass material, for the tops and limbs and chipped material, it makes a thinning actually a break-even or marginally profitable operation. Thinning in that country results in about 20 tons of biomass per acre, and the Enterprise School, which now heats with woody biomass, buys 800 tons a year, which supports about 65 acres of thinning each year on the ranch. And as Doug noted, when you have that market for the thin material, then you can get that work done. The thin trees grow faster. They're more resilient to insects and disease and fire. So these examples really illustrate that, you know, when we have those markets, we can increase the cost of forest management. We can decrease the fire risk, speed up implementation, in some cases enable stewardship with a big S on the federal land or stewardship with a small S on private land, enable that those activities to break even. We can, of course, reduce emissions from pile burning. One of the things that we've noted, and our DEQ colleagues will follow up on this more, is that if you're combusting this material in a controlled circumstance, like in a boiler with pollution control equipment, it reduces particulate emission by 95%. So that's an important consideration. And other folks will get into the local jobs. And we recently heard some good news from the EPA about their stance on considering forest biomass as a carbon neutral source. So if it's such a great idea and there's so many good benefits to it, why aren't we doing more? And that really relates to the market conditions for, you know, products that we can make out of this material. Renewable energy, particularly electricity, is the major source, and unfortunately, that market has been contracting due to the low price of natural gas. We have seen small but growing demand for thermal energy. We're now up to 19 facilities around the state that use biomass on a commercial and institutional scale, public schools, hospitals, airports. So that market is beginning to take hold, but it's not widespread yet. We're seeing other emerging markets like liquid fuels and biochar that are just beginning to pop up. And we're seeing interest in export opportunities in Asia. So the lack of market conditions and the lack of demand really puts a focus on market development. And we won't get too deep into this, but if we're thinking about market development or, you know, the role of the public sector, we should obviously be linking to state and federal priorities, federal land management, improved economic health for rural communities. But we should also be considering approaches that are technology neutral and product neutral, and that are statewide. You know, my experience has been that our funds and the support that we can provide have been targeted towards hazardous fuels reduction, And they've been targeted towards particular products, whether that's a renewable energy product, which has sort of been the focus. And if someone comes up with an idea that isn't in a place where we have hazardous fuels reduction or isn't a renewable energy product, there's very little public assistance which can support them. And so if the resource and its benefits are so important to us as a state, we need to be thinking about technology pathways that are neutral and not picking winners and losers, but providing a broad suite of support which can advance these markets so that we can achieve those benefits that biomass can provide. And lastly, that support should be done at a variety of scales. Recognition that we have entrepreneurs and businesses that are publicly owned and have resources to move things forward, and we have small mom-and-pop businesses in rural communities that need a different kind of support. So I'll just close with that, leave some time for questions, and turn it over to Levi Strayer from Bear Mountain Forest Products to talk about their business. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Chairman Roblin, members of the committee. Just want to shed some insight from...
You're going to introduce yourself again, because that's for the record.
For the record, Levi Strayer, Marketing Manager, Bear Mountain Forest Products. We have two plants here locally, one in Brownsville, the other's up in Cascade Locks. And both plants, we purchase forest residuals, like Marcus is talking about, to produce all of our products. That includes sawdust shavings and small diameter logs. And we use our sawdust and shavings for producing wood fuel pellets primarily, but also barbecue pellets, animal bedding pellets, wood fire bricks. And the small diameter logs we use to produce wood shavings and also our wood bricks. And right now, we currently get all of our residual products from lumber mills, Willamette Valley through the Columbia River Gorge. And but there is opportunity for the small diameter logs to come direct from the forest. And what you're seeing in some of the pictures here from Marcus, like the slash piles and that, those small diameter logs do have the ability to come direct to someone like us to turn that into a consumer product from there. And to give you an idea of market conditions for the products that we sell that are made from those forest residuals, we've really seen kind of a stagnation in the market over the last few years, basically flatlining out and not really seeing the amount of purchases for residential pellet stoves and for pellet boilers on an industrial level, whether it be schools or other locations. But seeing that kind of flatline out has kind of done the same for our products as well. And so we're kind of looking towards the future of how to be optimistic on creating incentives for people to get into those, to purchase pellet stoves or to take their business and install a pellet boiler. So they're looking long term of how to use a sustainable product that's coming out of our forests for their heating solutions. So we're optimistic that we can kind of work in that direction to help increase the demand for our products, that we can continually purchase more forest residuals from the forest, from lumber mills that are in the area here, and move in that. But in addition to some of those possible incentive type programs, we also look at the capacity of what our plants are making, and not only our plants, but mills across the western United States and even the whole country. But most of those that you would look at aren't even producing to full capacity at this point. And to give you an idea, like our plant here in Brownsville, we're producing, we could produce up to 20% more, which would be 20,000 tons annually that we could put out onto the market, but there's just not the demand for it. And so our Cascade Locks plant, we're actually looking at a $4 million investment up there that not only helps improve air quality and emissions coming out of the plant, but production capacity would increase by about 30% up there as well. So I think even from our plants and other plants that we work closely with, the capacity is there to produce a lot more and put it onto the market, whether it's domestically or, as Marcus mentioned, the international market's growing, that we would love to keep everything domestically as much as possible, but really focus on how to get consumers to increase that demand, to be able to utilize and kind of funnel back to our forests and our resources to be able to buy forest residuals and put them back into consumer products. And the last thing I'll make note on there, and I can touch on the export markets as well if you guys have an interest in that, but Marcus mentioned the Asia markets, and there's a lot of demand, I think, being built up there, primarily from power plants that are being converted over into biomass and versus coal and that generation there, but not as much residential heating. The demand is there for that through beginning to grow in South America, but especially Europe, Italy, France, and Northern Europe, of course. The demand for residential heating for woody biomass, wood fuel pellets, is really exploding over there at this point. But for us here on the West Coast, you know, freight rates to get to that location is very difficult. So we've focused on the Asian markets in Japan and for the export side of things. But if we can grow the domestic market, that's where we think there's a benefit to keep it local and you know, build it out here.
Any questions? Yes.
I just had a question. Levi, you talked about the small diameter logs. What size are you referring to?
You know, 12 inches or even a little bit bigger, down smaller. We use those, and we can shred them into like a chipper or the shavings, and we can use that to make those wood bricks, but also into shaving products for animal bedding and various other uses.
One other follow-up?
Yes.
Does that make a difference with the type of fiber in the sense of wanting more soft versus hard, or is it a combination? How does that work?
It can be a combination. We really focus on debarking it and using it from there to keep it a clean, burnable product.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. First of all, you know, I really appreciate you guys working on this, because I've always thought as this the market is the missing piece of the puzzle, and if we can grow that market, identify it, a lot of the other stuff will fall into place over a period of time. But my question is, Levi, is what can we do to build the? We've got to have the demand. Okay, we got to have the demand to make the market.
Right.
What can we do to build that demand?
You know, we've seen like the stove changeout program, where you incentivize someone to take an old, dirty, burning wood stove and turn that over into a clean, high-efficiency burning pellet stove. It's going to improve air quality. It's going to create that demand for more of the product. I'd say on a residential consumer side, that would be the most obvious one to go after. On more of the commercial or the industrial is to get those boiler systems in where you can put it into a school or organization or business situation and do more of a mass quantity that way. We would love to see where we could distribute even residential where it's bulk deliveries like you would an oil tank in someone's basement, where you can deliver in and deliver that year round, so it's not just when November, December hits, everyone wants to go to the store and pick it up, but they can deliver year round in bulk into that situation and have a boiler system in residential homes as well. That's something that we are continually studying in like Northern Europe, Sweden, Norway, and those situations. They are developing that market and very good at it. And, you know, long term, I think that would be a great direction for us to go, but the stove change out I think is the easiest and one to kind of get traction and getting people thinking that way and actually taking action and getting them over the hurdle of the initial investment of doing it,
because we're talking about a very large amount of debris. There's not a supply problem, and so it's about building markets. We've tried, you know, with the biomass plant in Medford. You know, we can't compete with other forms of generation. You know, and somehow we just if we could just get over that last hump, we would be well on our way. So I really appreciate your efforts into this. Yeah.
And I think it's really, the market is an issue, and I think that the ongoing conversation is whether this is sustainable and a green energy source and not has been one of the limiting factors. We have, I think we've finally come to the conclusion that they are now making them, it is a green carbon neutral deal. But it's taken a long time to get there. And so they lost market share to other forms of energy while we were waiting for that decision to come. And I thank actually Northern Europe and Europe for helping make that happen, because they've convinced, I think, parts of the rest of the world that this is a carbon neutral kind of program. So,
Mr. Chair, one of the kind of concerns that's come up along those lines over time has been the impact to air quality.
Right.
And so we've asked Palmer Mason from DEQ to come talk to you a little bit about kind of the differential between planned emissions through on a regular basis through a facility as opposed to the catastrophic impacts. And so I think we've got just to kind of close, bring our presentation to a close, I think we'll ask Palmer to join us up here and just touch on that briefly.
That'd be perfect.
Can we trade you out?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Palmer.
Thank you, Doug. Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Department of Environmental Quality. You asked me to come here today, and then the Department of Forestry asked me to come here today to talk about biomass and air quality. And I really want to cover two broad themes in that presentation. I want to talk a little bit about the health impacts of combustion, and then more specifically about the permitting of biomass facilities, which is, I think, as Doug alluded to, the main thing that you wanted to hear. When you burn any kind of material, whether it's biomass material or anything else, you do create health impacts. There are a number of pollutants that come from burning: carbon monoxide, nitric oxides, benzenes, and particulate matter. And the pollutant of greatest concern is particulate matter, and specifically fine particulate, which is about 2.5 micrometers or less. It's about like the 20th of the width of human hair. It's very small material that's left unburned in the process of combustion. And the problem with fine particulate matter is that it's easily inhaled, and when it is, it works its way into the bloodstream, and it can cause a variety of problems from asthma attacks to bronchitis to other respiratory issues, and including heart issues. So it is something that we have to look at carefully. With regard to permitting, as you've heard from the folks in forestry, it's true that if you're talking about a biomass facility that is well-run, well-maintained, well-engineered, we tend to see less risk impacts from those kind of facilities versus other sources, like the gentleman alluded to, unpermitted wood stoves and things like that. And the way our rules work is DEQ permits requires an air quality permit for facilities that generate, over 10 million BTUs per hour. And there are facilities that fall below that standard, and those include some of the biomass facilities that heat classrooms, heat some office buildings, and small hospitals. But there also are facilities that are over that 10 million BTU per hour standard and have been successfully permitted by DEQ, and I want to give you some examples of that. We've got lumber mills where energy from biomass is used to dry green lumber. An example is the Collins Pine Company Lakeview sawmill. We've got pellet mills where energy from biomass is used to dry wood material. There is the lumber facility in John Day. We've got cogeneration facilities where energy from biomass is used to produce steam and electricity. An example is the Interfor U.S. facility in Gilcrest. And finally, there are power plants where energy from biomass is used to make electricity. And an example of that is the Biomass One facility in White City. So we have successfully permitted large industrial facilities. And when we look at permitting those kind of facilities, we need to make sure that the standard is met for the entire community. And when you look at community risk, of burning biomass, you're looking at things like the location of the facility, proximity to people, the type of topography in the area, weather patterns, and the type of controls. And we do have in Oregon places where the air quality is challenged. And I'm primarily, again, talking about places where it's challenged around fine particulate matter. In those places, we can, again, permit the facilities, but the permitting will likely require more effective controls. It may even require offsets from the facility. One of the things that we want to encourage anybody who's looking at a biomass facility is to reach out to the department early in the process. We can try and help make the permitting process as painless as it can be, and that really is done if you can talk to us early. One of the key things that I want to talk about is the standard itself. It is a federal standard for fine particulate, and it is 35 micrograms per meter of cubic air. Again, that's a federal standard that DEQ is required to enforce. And the key thing about this standard is it's a standard, it's a community-based standard, and by that I mean when a facility comes in to get permitted, even though that facility may be very well run, very well maintained, and have some of the best possible emission controls, the contribution of that facility to the fine particulate in the community is counted against the contribution from all the unpermitted sources. So another way to say that is, even though you have a good facility that's going to have high emission controls, if the contribution is great enough from the unpermitted sources, the wood stoves and some of the facilities that DEQ doesn't permit, it can mean that facility either is not permittable or has to do a great deal more to reach that standard. So it puts a burden, if you will, on those industrial facilities to try to meet that standard. And a lot of that really comes down onto the specific location, topography, some of the other things that I was alluding to earlier. I'll conclude by just making a few more remarks here. I want to make clear that DEQ definitely recognizes the value of using locally generated materials as sources of energy and heat, and that there are many potential benefits that flow from biomass utilization, forest health, rural economic development, energy independence. We certainly recognize that. But in the same breath, I think I would point out that we feel like it's very important to address public health, particularly in these air quality challenged areas that I alluded to, and that where possible, we need to try to look at using the cleanest possible sources of biomass. And then one last thing that I would say is the role of the unpermitted sources here. You heard me mention that the federal standard, again, is a community standard, meaning that the contribution from those unpermitted sources weighs against the ability of an industrial source, or can weigh against the ability of an industrial source to meet the standard. So I think what that means from DEQ's point of view is that there's an opportunity here for us to look at trying to fix that part of the problem, that part of the equation, and that'll do a lot of things. It'll help clean up the air for the people who live in those communities by dealing with those unpermitted sources, and as the gentleman just alluded to, we can look at things like having better stoves that use pellets, that use some of this locally generated material that we're all talking about. So there may be some opportunities here for improving the air, making it easier for the permitting of these facilities, and do some of the rural economic development that we're all interested in. And with that, I'll take any questions.
I guess the only question I have is that, so when you're talking about community standard, if you're going to have slash burning or barrel burning that we do to get rid of our leaves and stuff in the fall, all that contributes to the ability to make or not make the standard. Is that correct? And forest fires themselves?
So, Chair Roblin, forest fires themselves are not included in the analysis under EPA regulations. Some of the other sources that you're alluding to, yes, would calculate towards that 35 micrograms standard. So it does depend on the specific source that you're talking about. But I will say this, I certainly recognize that on a short-term basis, a wildfire, or certainly a large one, represents a much larger health risk than a biomass facility. I mean, I understand that. It's just what EPA requires of DEQ is that we look at a long-term community standard and people's exposure over a period of time.
Any other questions?
Just a close for me. I hope this has been helpful. There's going to be plenty of opportunity in the full session to talk about biomass. The governor's recommended budget has two pieces in it for ODF. One is related to continuing to promote the pace and scale of restoration on federal forest lands, a federal forest package that we've talked to you about in September. That's one piece. Another piece is there is a package in there to promote biomass markets, which Marcus and others will be helping us with. So we'll be talking about that as we move through the Ways and Means process, and we'll be glad to follow up one-on-one with you or others when you have, if you have questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we'll close our informational meeting on forest health and biomass, and we will open an informational meeting on the Oregon State Fair Council update, Senate Bill 7 from 2013. So we can have all of those people come forward. And I will start by saying that it has been an honor for me to serve as a non-voting legislative member of the council. And Jean Durfler here is our chair, so we'll let Jean introduce people and start this off. And one of the things that happened with Senate Bill 7 was that we would come back with a report. They've already sent that report in from the State Parks Division, but we thought it would be good to introduce people. And I know a number of things have happened since we passed this bill a year ago, and we thought it would be great to have an update. So with that, Senator Jean Durfler.
Thank you. My name is Jean Durfler. I'm the chair of the council that was as a result of Senate Bill 7. I think in the bill it would ask us to report to the legislature as our progress in the development of a public corporation for the state fair. As you know, Senate Bill 7 passed last year. Governor was to appoint a committee to make a public corporation from the fair operation. And the governor appointed the committee, I think, after the first of the year, January, February. And we had our first meeting in March. Our first meeting, of course, we organized the committee, the council, and we set up a subcommittee process of the program, facilities, business, and communications. The program, of course, would be the entertainment and the things that would happen during the fair time. And the facilities, as you know, the facilities at the fair are not in great shape. There's not been a lot of money spent on maintenance over quite a few years. And so we have a facilities committee taking a look at what we might do to upgrade the facilities. The business community or business committee is set up to set up a new business, and it's there's a lot more to it than most of us realize. When you don't have a policy, you don't have a telephone system, and you don't have an IT system. There's an awful lot of things that have to take place to make it operational, and we've been involved in that, trying to get organized to take over the fair as of January 1. The first thing that we needed to do, of course, was to hire a CEO for the fair operation. And we were advised rather strongly that we shouldn't try to do that on our own, but that we should go through an organization that would locate people that would be qualified for the job. And so, like every industry, you find that there these things are already set up. California has a fair organization that does a lot of recruiting for fairs. And so we hired that organization to find us a CEO. We went nationwide on it. We had 30 applications from Florida to Alaska. It was rather interesting. I think we had 20 men and 10 women that applied for the job. We interviewed 6 of the candidates that we felt that were most qualified. And we ended up with our new CEO, and I'd like to introduce Mike Polishak. Mike comes to us from a fair down in California. He's been a CEO of that fair for a time, and he's been in the fair business for some 25 years. So we feel very fortunate to hire Mike, or to get Mike to come aboard. And it's kind of interesting because Mike's had a pretty good career down in California, doesn't really need to change jobs, but he found the frustration of trying to operate an entrepreneurial type business with county rules. And I always say it's kind of like playing basketball using football rules, because the rules that state government lives with are not suitable for an entrepreneurial type operation. So we feel very fortunate to have Mike here. And I'm going to let him say a few words when I get through talking here, so he can do that. It's a real challenge taking over an operation like the fair. You know, if you went back in the history of fairs, if you went back 50 or 75 years, say 75 years, the fair was probably the outstanding entertainment for the whole state for the whole year. It was a huge thing for the farm people to have a place to come and display their goods. And over the years, it's gotten less and less important as there's more types of entertainment taking place. There are fairs that are very successful. We have one just north of us, Seattle or Puyallup. It's very successful, and we have other fairs that are failing. And so our job as a committee is to try to find what makes fairs successful and implement that those operations. So we're going to take over as January 1. We have an awful lot of work to do. We've spent a lot of time trying to get set up as a business, but there's a lot more to do to make us operational. So I'm going to let Mike talk a little bit about what he's doing, and he took over as of December 1, so he's still trying to find out where everything is. So,
thank you, Chair Roble, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Mike Polishak. I'm the CEO of the Oregon State Fair and Expo Center. As Gene said, I have been in the fair industry for, actually, I started in 1978. I took about a 10-year sabbatical to start an event management, a consulting firm. During that period of time, I also did a lot of work for fairs, festivals, and fair-related businesses. Gene alluded to the fact that probably the thing that enticed me to and really got me very excited about this opportunity is that the passage of SB 7 really provides an unprecedented opportunity in our industry to create a business model that will allow the fair to thrive as more of an entrepreneurial enterprise. That's something that the industry is watching. The California Secretary of Agriculture, Karen Ross, is in particular is interested in how this model is shaped and how this approach works going forward, because there are a lot of fairs in California and elsewhere in North America that struggle trying to operate a very entrepreneurial type enterprise in a very bureaucratic environment. I've said for many years that I started at an amusement park, so we're not that much different in terms of the business that we do. The constraints of government I've said for a long time, we're not entrepreneurs and we're not bureaucrats, we're entrepreneurocrats, which is a copyrighted phrase, but you're welcome to use that. This opportunity really is something that I've been looking for a lifetime in the fair industry, and I really am very enthusiastic about what we can do. I think the Expo Center represents a real diamond in the rough. I'm falling in love with Oregon very quickly. My wife and I are relocating from the Bay Area. This is the fifth fairgrounds that I've managed, and the most exciting. So I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be in Oregon, and I look forward to communicating regularly with you. A wise man told me that those who communicate, cooperate, and facilitate are those that succeed, and I firmly believe that the council is committed to creating a business model that will allow the state fair to thrive going forward, and I'm thrilled to be part of that. So thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to introduce the other members of the board that are here, Gene?
Sure.
Who are those people?
Most people know Kerry Chuntek and John Chandler, and of course the famous representative Vicky Burger. We have an 11-member board right now, and we have one that has dropped off, but we are hoping that we can get Vicky to replace that position when she finishes her operations here at the state. Any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions? I will tell you that having been on the board the last 9 months or whatever it's been, it has been eye-opening to understand how much money our state has been putting into the state fair over the last number of years. It has been pretty remarkable, actually. And for those of us who live in rural communities, it is essential. I mean, we think of this fair as a really important part of what Oregon is and what our communities are, and our kids who aspire to get stuff at the fair and participate and do that kind of stuff. It's really important. And to know that we have, our state has been subsidizing it for a long time, is heartening to a lot of us in those rural areas, because we think it's really great. The issue is, we know that we have a responsibility on the board to get to a point where we really are self-sufficient, that we aren't asking for any money. But we know that it isn't going to happen in the first year. So we'll be back here looking at it. We've been looking at the books really carefully to make sure that people understand what we're going to ask for is just what we need to get by, and then put into place the hopefully new procedures that our new board chair, Barrett CEO, is going to inform us on. Just little things like getting sponsors for different events. When we were a state park, we can't do that. Now we can do those things. Those are the kinds of things that made it almost impossible to get to a place where you break even. When you look at all these other places, our universities get to have sponsors. You'd think the state fair would have the opportunity to do some of those things. So our hope is that with the guidance of a person who's been in the business for a long time, and with a really great board who care about the state fair, and with a parks department that has been really amazing to work with. When I think back and I see MJ's here and some others, they took over not because they wanted to, because we in the legislature said it is now the state parks. And then they had to figure out how to make that work. And I think they did a really good job. At the beginning, it was really horrible because we'd lost a lot of the people who came to the fair were upset because things hadn't worked. And the parks people brought them back and got a lot of information going, and I think set it up for Senate Bill 7 to work. But we have a lot of work ahead of us, and we know that. We really appreciate the quality of people who applied and the ability to select a really exceptional person. So thank you, Gene, for leading us this year, and for the other members that have been on there. It's really great. And for Vicky and I, we get to sit there and let you guys make all the decisions and just say, we want to support you in any way we can, because we don't get to vote. But I think both of us were really happy that we were able to. So thank you both for being here. Do any of the other board members want to come up and say a word? I don't think they really would. They're all shy people. As you'll find out, they're very shy.
I've already figured this part.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and thanks for the report, and look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you.
In the future. With that, we will close our informational hearing on the Oregon State Fair Council. And now we're going to open a conversation and an informational hearing on the Urban Growth Boundary Expansion Process, House Bill 2254 in 2013, and Carrie McLaren. And anyone else who wants to bring with them can come on up.
Bob Rudin. Keep me on task.
There you go.
Good morning, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. With me to my left is Bob Rindy, our Senior Policy Analyst, and the person who is actually doing the lion's share of work on our urban growth boundary streamlining process. And so I may defer to him from time to time, or he may chime in to either add or correct. So with that indulgence, I'll serve as his introduction. I want to thank you for providing us with the opportunity to come talk with you today. It's a bit of a placeholder, and I think you should have received a sort of one-pager about 2254, a list of our members of our rulemaking advisory committee, which is quite extensive, a basic outline of the steps we're providing, and then I think maybe a copy of the bill, although that's a little bit redundant for your body since you were the one that passed it. To set us up for today, what I really wanted to do was to provide a status update of where we are in the rulemaking. You may recall in 2013, the department had two primary bills that were legislative concepts. One is related to this, House Bill 2253. That was a process by which the department will be providing through Portland State Center for Population Research updated population forecasts for all communities in Oregon, a really necessary thing to bring the baseline work available to local communities. As a companion to that bill, there was House Bill 2254 focusing on streamlining urban growth boundaries. That bill also was passed unanimously by the legislature, something we're rather proud of, and our work has continued in good collaboration with the members of our Urban Growth Boundary Rulemaking Advisory Committee. That bill called for about a two-year rulemaking process. We are midway through that point right now, and thus the status update. The issue we were trying to solve really was in it with respect to urban growth boundaries was the length of time that it can take communities to go through the process, the complexity and the attendant costs with that process, as well as the uncertainty of appeals. We have the urban growth boundary process obviously has been around through the length of land use planning program, and we do, just to sort of set some scale, we have had in the last 10 years about 70 urban growth boundary expansions. So we know it's working for some communities. We also know that it's not working for other communities, and that's really where our focus was. We're on the growing communities. How can they have predictable, more cost-efficient, more meaningful analyses of their urban growth boundaries so that they can use their scarce resources to actually planning and implementing the development capacity and infrastructure planning for those lands? The effort for 2254 began with a design group and an overarching advisory committee to sort of set the structure, which is eventually what was passed in House Bill 2254. It set goals and priorities and provided really a good scaffolding for direction for the department and the commission to undertake the rulemaking. One of the primary bases I would just say to remind everyone is that these rules are for growing communities, and they are population-based. That was the directive of the legislation. Another directive in the legislation was to make them more predictable, make them less expensive, use a 14-year planning horizon instead of a 20-year planning horizon so that we were more focused on bringing infrastructure to those lands and making the lands development ready, that we would still continue to be at least as efficient in terms of our land use patterns as we have in the past. So really about doing a better job of the outcomes we've been achieving on the ground, but making those more more predictable. The list of committee members, I just want to provide a brief thanks to all of those. We have a number, one of which I think left the room. If John Chandler is still here from the Home Builders Association. I believe that Peggy Lynch from Oregon League of Women Voters may be sitting behind me. I want to call out those that are in the room. But we have about 25 people who are participating in this rulemaking advisory committee. We've had 7 meetings of the larger committee. We break down into smaller components to tackle each task. So we have been both extensive and, I think, intensive in the work that we've done. To orient you to where we are in the steps, and I thought I might just walk through them and the steps that we've outlined in the streamlined UGB process. And these are really structured around the legislation that was passed. The first one is to determine need. What's the need for development or for land that communities have? Those are required by the legislation to be set on a set of factors and ranges that will be established by the commission, all of which must be founded in empirical research, both of past development patterns and future market trends. Also with a regional focus to the extent that that affects those development patterns. So that's in step one. Step two then is to determine the capacity of the current urban growth boundary. And for those of you who are sort of immersed in this, that's what we typically refer to as the buildable lands inventory, what you already have inside. And again, we're in the process of developing a simplified inventory based on existing data that communities can go through to evaluate that process. Step three in the flow chart is really a math problem. You know what you need for the next 14 years. You know what you have currently. What's the unmet need, which is essentially then the amount of land by which a community needs to expand its urban growth boundary. We've really been working on that top row and are almost complete with that work, have some general consensus from the committee about where we're heading and the methodology that we have built there. I will say that this is an iterative process, so I think that there may be some work that we do on the bottom half of this diagram that influences or calls us to revisit some of the preliminary decisions made above. The work we're doing right now is really focusing on establishing study areas. And one area where 2254 is really different from the existing urban growth boundary process is that it allows communities to exclude certain areas which are determined to really not be worthy of study because they aren't going to produce good land for development. Those are areas that have natural hazards. Also areas that have been determined to be impracticable to serve, and some other focuses in terms of federal land ownership patterns or other natural resource issues. So that's where we are in this phase. Our rules are to be in effect on January 1st, 2016. So we will continue working on this and expect that our rules will be essentially in draft form by the summer, so that we can conduct the hearings around the state that we're required to under this bill and under our existing statutory requirements for implementing new administrative rules. So with that, a bit of a rapid-fire run-through, but really it's just to sort of say where we are. I expect that some urban growth boundary issues could come up before this legislative session, so I thought it was good to provide this committee with an update of the work we're doing and the subject matter that it covers. Bob, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'll just remind you that a key feature of this process is that it's an optional process, and we have the process that's been in place now for a decade at least, and that is the process that for some communities has been troubling, but for many communities has worked well.
Bob, you need to introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Bob Rindy with the
Department. Thanks for catching up.
And so there are still a number of communities that are working on sort of one way to think of it is the previous process, but it's the current process that this will replace. And by the way, Metro also follows that process. So just to point out that when we're all done here next year,
there would still be two options for communities. They can do it the old way or what we presume will be, we actually intend to be a much more streamlined process, but it will be up to each city.
So that was one of my questions. So that using the Portland State population forecast, you can do that. This process will make that even easier and help. But you could go about figuring it out yourself, which some communities have done in the past, trying to figure out what that growth pattern is, which is taking a lot of time and money in the past. So
Yes, Chair Roland, that's true. We will have two urban growth boundary evaluation and expansion systems that local communities can choose from. Our aim here is to really cover those communities that are growing and those communities that therefore really would benefit from a more cost-efficient and predictable process. There may be circumstances where that more streamlined and then what often happens with it somewhat more narrow path doesn't work for a community, and so they have the flexibility to choose to use the existing urban growth boundary expansion and evaluation process. We are developing in the rules a way that communities who may be already underway on their urban growth boundaries can decide if they would like to come under the new process. So we're really trying to achieve that flexibility and clarity of outcomes for all communities as they enter their evaluations.
Because I will say that the time I've been in the legislature, one of the most frustrating things that we've had to deal with are urban growth boundaries. And the new way of doing urban growth boundary expansion, and that's by locating a school outside of it, coming to the legislature and getting us to incorporate it and say that it's okay for this one little spot, at which time all the services are provided down that road to get to that school, and urbanization happens in this new block between the school and the raid, and then it gets eventually taken in weirdly. And because you can't afford any property inside their growth boundary to build a school on when they're rapidly growing, and they've got all these kids and there's no place to do it. So they've got to find a place to build a school, and it almost inevitably ends up outside their growth boundary and in the legislature. And I would really like it not to. I mean, that would be a goal of mine, would be really helpful. And I love schools, and I think they're really important. And when communities are growing, schools have to be there. I mean, there's no doubt that that happens. And when you have to pay so much money for your land, you can't build the building you need to build. It gets really, I understand the conflict that's inherent in the system we have right now, and hopefully this will have those needs considered more adequately at the beginning of the process. I came to the conclusion a long time ago in my own mind that we should put a lot of big parks in the urban growth development that are parks that can be used for schools if we have to, part of them, so that there's at least a place where you can locate a school in an urban growth boundary. Right now, we don't have those spaces, and the price that gets paid for other kinds of development, condos to whatever, makes it impossible to put the school there. So I hope as you have this conversation, you're thinking about, and I'm sure you are, all those different things that are weighing on making these decisions really hard for local communities. So.
Yes. Short answer.
But anyway, it needed to be fixed because we actually had the opportunity to work on a little town called Damascus last number of sessions.
Did you have to bring that up?
And it's part of this whole process.
I mean, it is.
and so I would love to see a more systematic approach to making things work better in the future. And I commend you for doing it because it is not easy, because for every solution for one person, it's a problem for the other person, and it makes it really difficult to have that conversation. So.
Well, Chair Roblin, just two things. Thank you for that support. Just to clarify, because I want to set reasonable expectations, unfortunately, this does not apply to the metro region.
I know.
And
we
so I can't fix Damascus inside of this
we
bill.
We know
so,
that.
Okay, I just I want to.
We didn't know that.
I don't want to unfairly sell you something here that we can't deliver at the department. But we do share your ultimate desire and outcome. And one of the reasons why, I just again highlight, we make this an optional process. So we're not taking something off the table. We're adding something, which I will say we did essentially put performance metrics in here. So this is supposed to be a urban growth boundary process that is deemed viable and actually used by the majority of communities going through UGB. So we do have that call and that task to actually make this be functional and to demonstrate that in our performance metrics.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this group? Thank you again. And we look forward to seeing that final product.
Yes, so do we.
With that, we will close our informational hearing or meeting on the urban growth boundary expansion process. And we will open an informational hearing and meeting on the Washington Growth Management Act. And with that, we have a number of people in the audience. So I will start by just having Dave, do you want to come up, Honeycutt, and whoever you think needs to be up here in the first panel? I know we have county judges, Steve Schaefer, Gilliam, Gary Thompson from Sherman, and Chris Perry from Wheeler. If you guys want to raise your hand just so we all know that you're here, and we appreciate you being here. Because I know that this bill is in large part looking at what kinds of things maybe could make it possible for you to get some things happening in your counties. So, and Washington has looked at what we've done and come up with other processes. So I appreciate the ability to have some people here. So with that, I will turn it over to Dave to start this in any way you wish. And thanks for other legislative members being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here on Washington's Growth Management Act, and in particular LC 919. We have talked for years in this building, and it seems like it's become more dire as time has gone on, about the need to figure out what we can do to help the struggling parts of this state succeed economically. And one of the areas that we so frequently discuss is Eastern Oregon. Whenever you talk about making changes to our statewide land use system, you seem to find yourselves at the mercy of the fear of the unknown arguments. Well, if we allow a county to have some self-determination, we change some of the rules to give counties a little more flexibility in those parts of our state that are struggling, we're going to have this parade of horribles and all of these things that are associated with that. What I hope that the committee and that that the legislature focuses on, and one of the tasks that we have for this upcoming session, is to get folks to realize the fear of the known. And here's what we know. The LC 919, and I won't go into it in much detail unless the committee is really interested in the guts of the bill, but it would affect eight Eastern Oregon counties: Wheeler, Gilliam, Sherman, Grant, Lawa, Malheur, Harney, and Baker. Those eight counties in the last, and I went back to 1950 and compared the population of those counties in 1950 compared to what it is today. Those counties, and we'll start with Malheur. In 1950, Malheur County had 23,000 people in it. 2012, it's got 30,000 people in it. So it's actually grown a little bit, but it's shrinking from the 2010 census. They're actually losing people in Malheur County. Harney County, 6,113 people in 1950. Today it's got 7,212 people. It's grown by a whopping 900 people, but it's shrinking as well. It's losing population. Grant County had 8,300 people in 1950. Today it's got 7,300 people. It's actually it's lost people in the last 60 years, and it's shrinking. Baker has lost about 200 people in the last 60 years. It continues to shrink. Wallowa has lost 400 people. It's shrinking. Wheeler County went from 3,313 people in 1950 to 1,424. They've lost half their population, over half their population in 60 years, and they continue to shrink. Gilliam has lost 900 people, and Sherman County has lost 500 people. What the pattern points to is that if we recognize the fear of the known, these counties are dying on the vine. And it doesn't take any more than a drive over to those areas to see exactly what is happening over there. These counties have a combined population of about 75,000 people in 35,000 square miles. Okay, it's about a third of the state with 75,000 people. There's 77,000 people in Medford. So what we have here is a part of our state that is tremendous, that is suffering tremendously. They're losing population. Their unemployment rate is always higher than the unemployment rate in the valley. Their percentage of people living above the poverty line is higher than what it is over on this side. And their average family, the median family income is lower than what it is over here, and much lower when you compare them to adjoining states. Part of that problem, we believe, is the result of our statewide centralized land use planning system. Now, I say part, and we don't know exactly for sure, and we don't know, again, because we haven't tried it, we don't know what the outcome would be if we went to a system more like the state of Washington. But Washington, who established their Growth Management Act, patterned after Senate Bill 100, but done years after Senate Bill 100 was enacted, has a provision that allows the small, non-growing Washington counties to opt out. And 10 of the 39 Washington counties opted out, okay, from at the start. 10 of the 39 small, non-growing Washington counties opted out. Perry Houston, who is seated to my left, is a planner in Okanagan County, one of the counties that opted out. And prior to that, he was a county commissioner for years in Kittitas County, which opted in to the Growth Management Act. So we have someone here that I think can really help the committee understand the differences between what we have here and the Growth Management Act. And since Senator Hansel represents some of the counties that would benefit from this, Representative Bentz represents some of the other counties that would be affected by this bill, we're hoping that you'll entertain this bill and give us a chance to get those rural counties, give them some hope that they can get off their feet and make something happen economically over there.
Thank you. So who would we like to have hear from next?
Well, I suppose we ought to hear from
Good Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair Roman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, Senator from District 29, which includes, I believe, three of the counties in my district that would be affected by this bill. I kind of bring perhaps a unique perspective in that for 30 years prior to coming to the Senate, I was a member of the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners. And I was a brand new commissioner when we adopted the final draft of our land use plans. Governor Vic Atiyah is on the signature block along with my uncle Stafford Hansel, who was chair of LCDC at the time. So for 30 years, worked with the system from the very beginning until I took here as a state senator with the land use plans here in Oregon. One thing became very clear, continue to herald that wherever I go, is that one size does not fit all. If we want to have a comprehensive plan that really works, and I think the decades that we've had Senate Bill 100 would show that. The great opportunity we have here, I think, is that our neighbors to the north created a program that we could really benefit from. especially in these parts of rural Oregon, could. And I would very much encourage us to look at it. LC 919 does that. I think with it would provide an opportunity, give us an opportunity in eastern Oregon to see what we can do with it. Makes a lot of sense. I'm more than happy to, in fact, I was asked if I'd be one of the chief sponsors of it. I said I would, but if there's a possibility to do a committee bill, I'd support that as well. So whichever way is the best way to move this forward, I'm happy to support it. But it's needed, and we have a model that works, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel, and I think we ought to do it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was talking about this. Cliff Bentz, District 60, I represent four of the counties that are involved in the, that would be helped by this bill. So Eastern Oregon is becoming a place to drive through, quick as you can. It's a beautiful view, but you don't stay. And that's happening more and more and more as the populations age. It's very difficult to bring people onto farms or ranches because of challenges with building restrictions. And as a result, we have older and older people doing the work. We have other things that are conspiring to remove population from that area. The mechanization of agriculture and the streamlining of different processes has reduced the needed number of people. All of these things mean that we need to do something to bring people there that we're not currently doing. I'm not sure what that is. We've been trying with some limited success and with the help of LCDC and others over the past 3 years to add industrial lands to my counties, and that's been of some help. And I'm very, very happy for that. We all are. The odd thing is that many of the rules that apply, that make so much sense, perhaps, for Portland or Hillsboro or Salem or Eugene, make no sense in an Ontario Vale, a John Day, a Lakeview. And I'll just point out that when you build a house in a small town, you're taking an enormous risk of never getting the money back from it, that not having a buyer for it. So you don't. You move into an older house and you wait to see what ultimately is going to happen. And this means, though, if you do build in town, you don't want, when something finally shows up, some factory that's probably going to be ag-related, to be built next door to you. And yet that is what happens under our current rules. You can't put it out in a way. It's outside the urban growth boundary. So it's the weirdest thing. It's almost as though these rules conspire to empty out our small towns. So we need to do something. And this is another try, and I'm hopeful for it. It's never been our purpose, I think, to upset Oregon's land use planning process that has worked so well in so many ways. But we got to do something. So I really appreciate you taking the time to listen.
Thank you. I would love to hear Washington's system a little bit better. I've looked and read about it some, so would love to have you. And please introduce yourself at the beginning, so for the record.
Will do. Mr. Chairman, honored committee members, I am Perry Houston. I am from now Okanagan, Washington, nestled against the Canadian border. In terms of, I guess, resume, shall we say, pedigree, if you prefer, I've spent now almost 8 years in Okanagan County as the Director of Planning and Community Development. Okanagan County is a non-GMA county. We do not plan under RCW 3670A. Prior to that, I spent 8 years as a Kittitas County Commissioner. Kittitas County, Ellensburg, if that's more familiar, smack in the center of the state, and they were a GMA county. Now, by way of history, the Growth Management Act of Washington started as Initiative 547 in 1990, went to a vote of the people, was soundly defeated in all counties. It passed in no county in the state of Washington. I believe it was 75% and change no, 24% and change yes. So, I mean, it was a decisive defeat. The legislature did enact the Growth Management Act that following session, but I believe, in deference to the message the electorate sent, they only required the larger counties to plan under the Growth Management Act, 50,000 and over was the mark. The rest of the counties were given the opportunity to plan under the Growth Management Act. They weren't required to, and all but 10 opted in. So to be precise in language, it wasn't that they opted out, they just elected to not opt in. The legislation that was adopted last year gave four of the smaller counties that had opted in the opportunity to opt out. So by way of kind of history there. So what that does give us, I think, is the opportunity to look at counties that have been required to plan under the Growth Management Act versus counties that were not, and see just exactly what happened on the ground. Frankly, I don't know that I put myself forward as an expert in the Growth Management Act, but I am a survivor of the Growth Management Act wars. And there were many, and they were bitter. And I guess maybe I should back up a little bit farther. My earliest post in government was as a police officer in the Ellensburg Police Department. Started as a radio operator and retired as a patrol sergeant due to injuries. So I can speak personally to the challenges of enforcing law that nobody believes is necessary and that nobody agrees with. From a front seat of a patrol car, that's a daunting experience. And I have some experience with that. And I would suggest land use planning should learn from those models. When you compare Kittitas County, and let's look at the circumstance, in 90 minutes from Kittitas County, I can be smack deeply involved in the traffic snarls of the greater Seattle area. I can drive 90 minutes in Okanagan County and not get any place in particular. Population is essentially the same. Change over 40,000 apiece. Kittitas County, of course, was continuously under appeal in the Growth Management Act. And I'm going to suggest, and let me tell you right up front, I'm going to come back and I'm going to tell you the good points in the Growth Management Act, because there are good points to it. I'm starting with some of the challenges, because I think there's a message in that for what you're discussing here. Kittitas County, when I was elected to the Ellensburg City Council, where I spent 7 years prior to my post in commissioner, I was elected the year following Kittitas County's decision to opt in to the Growth Management Act. My first assignment was to the Conference of Governments, which was charged with writing the countywide planning policies and the other public participation documents required by the Growth Management Act. I'll come back to that. That's a good thing that the Growth Management Act required. I had the honor and privilege of assisting in ending, settling one of the final appeals, my first, maybe my second year as a Kittitas County Commissioner. So we were talking about a 7-8 year process to come up with a compliant growth management plan. Now, it's something of a misnomer, because Kittitas County was essentially appealed every year to the Growth Management Hearings Boards. And here's where some of the challenges come about. Local process arrived at a plan, and in Kittitas County, it was within the structure of the Growth Management Act. Nothing is 100%, as you know. I don't know your experience as an elected official. Even when I was unopposed, I didn't win with 100%. So there's always someone who will disagree. And if that someone is willing to appeal you to the Growth Management Hearings Board, then despite the language in Growth Management Act that says you're to give deference to local decision-making, despite the compliance with the public participation process, despite the compliance with the general structure required of the plans under the Growth Management Act, the Hearings Board would insert an entirely different planning philosophy, and we struggled mightily to come into compliance. Now let's go to Okanagan County. We've had a comprehensive plan in place since 1964. On my watch, we are poised to adopt revisions, literally in 2 weeks, to that 64 comprehensive plan. We have zone code. We comply with the Shoreline Master Program and the Critical Areas Ordinance, which is an element of the Growth Management Act that everyone has to comply with. Same with the designation of resource lands. I'm not required to enact development regulation regarding resource lands, but I am required to designate it. And we have a plan that many will tell you allows rampant development, completely unbridled and destroying the landscape, and you have others that will tell you I've stripped them entirely of their private property rights. They have absolutely no opportunity to do anything. But the reality is, if you look at the landscape in Okanagan County, compare it to a growth management county, I'm not convinced you'll see much difference. We have strong policy that supports agriculture. We have strong policy that supports the resource industries. We have low-density residential development, which I realize for some is comes right out of a book of diagnostic diseases. But the reality is those folks that live in our low-density residential areas are also our volunteers for Little League. They are our citizens whose children attend schools. They just live differently than the folks in town who also provide their contributions to, if you will, the social cohesiveness that is part of any community. The difference is Kittitas County always had to go to someone else to ask if the plans that they worked out locally were acceptable. I yet don't have to do that. When the Board of County Commissioners adopts a plan after the years of bloodletting and the compromise and the public hearings and everything else, it's our plan, at least so far. We'll see how that goes, because this is the first revision of the major revision of the Okanagan County plan since the adoption of the Growth Management Act. So we'll see if they try to thrust us into some of that review process. In broad strokes, I guess that's my history, if you will. The message I would offer, and if you think about it, it really makes a certain amount of sense. 1% population growth in Garfield is 24 people. 1% in King County is 1,930. That's a different set of circumstances. Okanagan County, Tree Fruit. Gebers Farms has managed to expand their operations despite not having the protections of the Growth Management Act for agricultural operations and resource land. Other places, it's dry land wheat. Some places have water, some places don't. Those are all local circumstances, and those all have to be taken into account when you create a workable local comprehensive plan and then the zoning that informs. If you fail to take into account those local circumstances by the insertion, if you will, of a statewide planning philosophy, pretty soon you have something nobody wants to follow, and that's a problem. And that's a problem. If you can give your counties, large or small, the opportunity to create more carefully crafted local plans, I think you'll find it serves a benefit. Now, that's the, let me back up, as I promised you, I'd tell you about the advantages to the Growth Management Act. The public participation structure is a good thing. There's no reason why any county in the state shouldn't afford its citizens ample opportunity to participate in those plans. That's good law. The processes developed for cities and counties to work together, come to reconciliation on urban growth areas where the cities can expand. That's good law. That has actually assisted in managing growth, and it's assisted in economic development because the cities now have some assurance in terms of where their boundaries are going to go, therefore can extend services, where before they didn't have that protection. To actually go through and conduct the environmental review is good. Everyone should ask the same questions in terms of what they're reviewing their local plans for. The answers are going to be different, and that's understandable and not a bad thing. But there's no reason why everyone shouldn't ask the same questions. So the good points of the Growth Management Act. There has been some push in past to make all the counties come into compliance with the Growth Management Act. It has never moved forward. And I think because no one has really seen the downfall of land use management, comprehensive planning, in the non-GMA counties. I think with that, that's the background. If there are specific questions, I can certainly respond to them.
Questions? I guess my question is, do you feel, and I guess this would be a feel, or maybe there are some economic indicators, that Okanagan economically is doing better than they would have had they been in the situation that the other one is? Or is it more about the people who are there feeling that they have more control over their lives, and therefore the tone of the county government is different?
I'm not going to suggest that comprehensive planning is the only driver in terms of economic sustainability, but I will suggest we've had greater flexibility to respond to the opportunities. If we had an opportunity to expand residential development, someone was willing to put the money in to take the risk, we could afford that opportunity within the boundaries, obviously, of local project review. Is there enough water? Were there roads? That sort of thing. Which under the Growth Management Act, we may not have had that level of flexibility. We've also been able to afford the agriculturalists the opportunity to do other things with their land to create a more diversified portfolio. And any economist will tell you the more diversified your income generating activities are, the greater the likelihood that your operation is sustainable. They can do a little bit of residential development. They can do some additional commercial development. They can do their agricultural activities. They have greater flexibility, and I would suggest that is an advantage that we enjoy as a non-GMA county.
The other question I'd have is that you have BC mostly to your north. Are there companies that have moved across the border because they have advantages there that you don't have in Okanagan? As we've seen a movement of a number of our companies from Eastern Oregon to Idaho, and it may be because of, we know it's in part because of the different structures that the government has with land use. Have you seen any of that up in that part of the country? Now, it's a fairly different than state to state as opposed to state to federal, but.
What I can say, I don't know that I can give you an example of an existing operation that moved.
Okay.
I can tell you, City of Ellensburg, for instance,
right,
was is from time to time examined for companies that wish to relocate. And one of the examples comes immediately to mind was Stansport, the big apparel outfit, was looking around the nation. I mean, we weren't on the short list, but we were part of the sites that we're looking at. And one of the reasons why we weren't suitable was the lack of housing. Not the lack of affordable housing, the lack of housing. And I would be surprised to learn that when counties, Eastern Washington counties to in particular, are looked at by companies that are looking to relocate, I would be amazed to find that the lack of housing stock isn't part of the problem. Now, in the GMA counties, to remedy that can be a daunting task. In the non-GMA counties, while there's certainly other factors, at least we have some local flexibility and can try to meet that demand when it's identified.
Okay. Other questions? Well, I appreciate it, and I really appreciate our senators from Eastern Oregon and some of these rural. I felt fairly rural until I heard the numbers, and now I recognize that my coast is rural, but it's not that rural.
Not frontier.
It's not frontier, yeah, exactly. That was amazing. So thank you. And thank you for coming all this way from a beautiful part of the state of Washington, actually. I grew up in Port Angeles, so not far from Okanagan. But I know, and I know where it is. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we will end our informational meeting on the Washington Growth Management Act. We are now at that point where we need to look at, and I have a list of bills that we would like to introduce as committee bills, and I want to make sure that as I do that, I make the statement that voting to introduce them as committee bills has no indication that you are in favor or support or don't support those bills. It is only whether or not we believe that they should be introduced as committee bills and then sent off to whatever committees they get in. And I tell people that too, because people think that because we introduce them to this committee, they'll end up here. I looked at a few of these. Some of these would not end up here regardless of whether or not we were. It just happened that we were doing them. And I have had numbers of groups ask if we could put some. These are the final group that I put down as bills that I would be considering as committee bills. And so that's where it's at. But I want to make sure people know that voting for introduction of committee bills has nothing to do with your support or non-support of any of them. So with that,
did you open the session?
Oh, I will open a work session on introduction of committee bills for the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. You have a list in front of you. Are there any additions, subtractions, anything else you'd like to talk about? Do you want to go through each one of them? Do you want to do?
Should we have a motion first?
That's what I'm trying to figure out, what kind of motion we want to have. One or all of them?
Well, we probably need to somehow identify what we have that we're going to be putting in.
Okay.
In some
so
capacity.
Beth, do you want to go through that real quick?
At least just by
number.
Just
go through the number, all of them?
Sure.
very quickly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are 10 on the list, and if you want me to go into any detail on any of them, I'd be happy to, but the list is LC 919, LC 1340, LC 1388, LC 1445, LC 1447, LC 1479, LC 1543, LC 1649, LC 1953, and LC 1954. They are also all available on OLIS for anyone who would like to look at them.
And so 19 is the one that we just heard from the rural communities.
Right.
LC 1953 is about, it was kind of a placeholder bill that we put in from the Oregon Fair Council, from our group that here, that says we need to figure out what that amount will be, but we need to have a bill there in case there is resources to support the fair. And that's also 1954. Both of those do that. N- 1649 came to us because there are a number of small communities on, in our area that would love to have natural gas provided, but they don't have any, and they're trying to figure out, is there anything that can be done to support, like we did with rural electrification and others, getting services to some of those places, and that's the conversation behind
need
it.
We need to sell them pellets.
That's true. maybe we need to work on pellets. Why don't we do that one? If serves me right, was that's the one that will allow us to subcontract with other smaller communities and units to do the work that LCDC, that some of our counties can't do by themselves, and they can't afford a full person to do that. 1479, I don't know if people have had the concerns that I have had at different times with respect to the requirements for architectural paint stewardship program and how it's being run and the cost of money it's taking. A number of the counties in Eastern Oregon have not been able to get it to work, and so they've asked for a bill to be introduced that includes looking at that stewardship program in a different way. Out 1447 is one that's come up every time. It certainly won't end up here because it's an elections bill. But it has to, it's the county clerks have looked at how can we do some things where we don't have to have these elections for these small boards where there's nobody opposing a particular person. And it's kind of reducing the number of people on a ballot and kind of keeping that under control.
The irrigation districts.
Maybe. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them, actually, where
nobody ever,
where you have very few people running, and it creates a lot of extra work. There's three or four of those clerk ones here. So, and 1340 repeals a sunset that we've required on the bill we passed a while back that allowed us to use some of the money from the timber funds that goes to roads for patrol on those roads. I think the counties have been pretty responsible in using it, so I... So that's pretty much them. And if others have others that they would like introduced, I was hoping if there was anybody else, we'd be glad to entertain any. But this is the group that had come to me to this point. And I would entertain a motion.
You want me to make it?
Sure.
Okay. Chair Roblin, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 919, dated 10-16-14, LC 1340, dated 9-18-14, LC 1388, dated 9-24-14, LC 1445, dated 11-6-14, LC 1447, dated 11-12-14, LC 1479, dated 10-24-14, LC 1543, dated 12-2-14, LC 1649, dated 10-23-14, LC 1953, dated 11-5-14, and LC 1954, dated 11-5-14.
Is there any discussion? Again, I want to make sure that everybody understands for the record that voting for this motion does not indicate anybody's favorability towards any one of these or not. It just allows them to be introduced pre-filed as committee bills. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing no opposition, motion passes. I want to thank everybody for being here today and for the testimony of all the people that came before us today. Look forward to meeting when we get back in session, wherever and whatever we are, and whatever the Senate President and others decide we will be doing. So between now and then, again, I want to thank each and every one of you for your service on this committee, because I think this is the last time we will meet as a committee during the interim and before the session begins. So again, thank you very much, each and every one of you. I have enjoyed it immensely, and it is always interesting that you get on a committee and you think you have an understanding of what you may hear, and then you find out you didn't have any understanding of what you might hear. So I appreciate the process that gets us the bill but more knowledge. And with that, I will adjourn our committee, our interim committee on rural communities and economic development, just before 11 o'clock. Just before 11 o'clock.